Spirit Blade Underground, episode 334. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 334.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and very unique community you're invited to check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you, like me, to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.net. Meanwhile, on the show today, a review of Left Behind, starring Nicolas Cage, and some Trek talk as Matt McKinney talks about his favorite Star Trek episode ever. Plus, we get back into the book of Hebrews with a brief recap of the book so far and some thoughts on why this book is valuable for us geeks today. Okay, here we go. Well, thank you all for joining me on this historic day. The serum I've created will give anyone who drinks it the power to objectively know the difference between something that is cool and something that is lame. The serum is available to anyone who provides a review for the Spirit Blade Underground podcast and is completely safe. Allow me to demonstrate. Left Behind, starring Nicolas Cage and Leah Thompson. The IMDb synopsis for this movie says, a small group of survivors are left behind after millions of people suddenly vanish and the world is plunged into chaos and destruction. That sounds like a pretty cool premise. Maybe not a terribly creative one, but a good one. Oh, man. I'm going to cut to the chase. This is an offensively bad movie. It is a tragic shame that they had the core cast that they did in Nicolas Cage, Leah Thompson, Chad Michael Murray, who you might know from One Tree Hill, and Cassie Thompson, who I don't really, she's a familiar face to me, kind of, but I don't really know her from anything. But they had this really nice core cast of well-known faces and solid actors who give, in this movie, solid performances. But they are surrounded by just a painfully subpar experience. Man, it's such a shame. I really want to fast forward 20 years from now to the interviews with Nicolas Cage and Leah Thompson, especially Nicolas Cage, where he opens up about why he did this movie. Why did it sound like a good idea to him? What passionate, I assume Christian, convinced him to be a part of this? You know, I'm wondering, you know, are these cast members who have these, you know, at least two of them, especially Nicolas Cage, have these solid film careers in mainstream filmmaking. Even though Nicolas Cage is kind of doing some quirky roles and stuff, some slightly more independent stuff, he's doing what he wants to do, you know? And I don't know if he's a believer or not. I have no idea. But I mean, I still wonder either way, just as a solid filmmaker himself, as a man who knows what's involved in making a good film, what attracted him to this? Because he brought the goods, and so did the other less than handful, I guess, of actors that were kind of featured prominently in this. But the material they had to work with and the everything else about the movie is just really rough. I made some notes here. First off, let me mention that the director, Vic Armstrong, has a long history in Hollywood involved in making some fantastic films, some of my favorite films, The Amazing Spider-Man, Green Hornet, and like tons of others that aren't necessarily geek films, but like are well-known and, you know, did really well and are, you know, celebrated movies, really much very highly enjoyed movies. But he was a part of all those movies as a stunt coordinator. So this is his first film as a director, as far as I know, as far as IMDb knows anyway. The movie starts off with a slow start before they get to the main event, which is the disappearance of all these people. The script is just bad. It's not always terrible, and when handled by the solid actors, then it works pretty well. But it's got lots of contrived lines, some exposition lines, you know, that are really obvious. It's got some characters that are just the supporting characters in this movie are like filled with stereotypes, and there's a dramatic difference at times between the main core cast and some of the supporting cast that still have lines that are still characters in the story, as opposed to just background performers, you know. And the supporting characters are littered with some people who I would expect to see in a skit on a Sunday morning service, you know. And I use the word skit in the most, I guess, low and demeaning way I possibly can. The most, I wouldn't call, like when we did drama ministry at our church years ago, you know, we called them, you know, dramas or, you know, whatever. Even if they were comedies, we called them dramas. Skits just seemed kind of like, you know, just light and substanceless, you know, just kind of silly, whatever, you know. And that's what where some of these actors seem to come from is like, you know, they just volunteered and they said, boy, I really love Jesus. I'd be happy to be a part of this movie. You're hired, you know. Oh man. Cast and performances. Okay. So, I want to talk about Nicolas Cage, who does a great job in this movie. You know, he can sometimes have some moments in his movies where it's like he makes weird choices, but other times, you know, he makes bold choices that really work and can be kind of a daring performer. And when it works for him, it really works for him, and it's unique and interesting. And he really brought the goods this movie without any weird Nicolas Cage-ness. So if that kind of normally turns you off, I don't think there's any of that going on in this movie. He just brought really a solid performance. Did not seem at all to be phoning it in. He seemed invested in the story and in his performance. So that was great. Lea Thompson, she plays Irene, a woman who just became a Christian a year ago and is, you know, thought by the other characters who know her to be kind of like a Bible thumper, but I wouldn't describe her that way. About 80% of her performance, she came across as like a genuine, grounded person. 20%, there was just a little bit of that kind of weird artificial, you know, Christian mom stereotype, just a touch of that, but not much. And so I really felt like she brought the goods as well. Chad Michael Murray, who you might know from One Tree Hill, he's, you know, a CW show, I believe, years ago, and he's kind of been a pretty boy type actor in other things and movies since then, and so he's kind of slowly growing out of that phase of his career, I think, and he did a good job in this movie. He wasn't given a lot of weighty stuff to do in his performance, but I feel like if this franchise continues, that he could potentially, you know, do what he would need to do as a character like Buck Williams from the Left Behind books. Cassie Thompson, a face that's a little familiar to me, but I don't really know her from anything. She was possibly the standout performer in this. I really was invested in her scenes as much as I could be with the distracting, terrible elements surrounding her. She really, you know, brought class and skill and, you know, to just quality to her scenes. So that was really well done. Let's talk about the stunts and visuals, though. Speaking of Cassie Thompson in her role as Chloe, there's one scene where she is obviously in front of a green screen. Now, I have a good eye for picking out green screen, but not only was the background looking kind of green screeny, but there were like green artifacts remaining in her hair from the green screen she was standing in front of. I was like, this is just not excusable. This is terrible, terrible. So, sorry, I can put that sign down now. Anyway, yeah, that was just a shame. There are several CG planes, at least two, I think, that have to do like crash landings in this movie, and they both look terrible. The animation looks totally unrealistic. They stop weirdly abruptly, and when they hit the ground, the physics does not look right at all. I mean, it looks like PS2, PlayStation 2 era physics, game animation physics, you know, but just with a nice layer of high def pasted over it. Yikes. Let's see here. The shooting style in general, I think, felt static or dated. It reminded me of, you know, TV style shooting. Just the way that they would, you know, what they showed in the shots and how the camera moved and stuff. So you might, if you're not kind of aware of those kinds of things, you might just watch this movie and feel like, boy, this feels like just weird, or it feels dated, or it feels just cheesy or wrong, but you can't put your finger on it. And I think it's related in part to the camera and how they use the camera in this movie. But for me, the biggest thing that dated the movie, that made it seem emotionally unrealistic or forced or whatever, was the score. A man by the name of Jack Lenz, I looked it up on IMDb, was responsible for the score in this movie. And as I was watching it, from the very beginning, it felt like the kind of score you would expect from 1990s TV drama, and I mean like on the lighter side of TV drama, at least in the conversational scenes, like Seventh Heaven type stuff. It's kind of saccharine and sweet, and it tells you too much of what you're supposed to feel in a given moment. And then during the action scenes, you know, it's like this they use like a drum kit, like a drum, like a guy on a drum set, you know, so it's like, oh, there's danger, so ooh, there's danger, what we gonna do, you know, and like, oh, you know, we gotta like get into our action mode and stuff, and it feels like a 1990s cop show action sequence. I mean, it's not right. I think that this movie would be bumped up significantly in its quality if you just removed the entire score. That might feel a little bit weird, but I would rather have this kind of grounded, independent type feel with no score at all than what they gave us in the score for Left Behind. Really disappointing there. In terms of relevance, no one's going to talk about any of the message of this movie, because they're going to be talking about how bad the movie was. Nobody's going to talk about, you know, they're not going to talk about the rapture. They're not going to talk about Jesus. You know, some well-meaning Christian who, you know, just goes out to see Christian movies might see this movie and they might really be moved by it. You know, like a, anyway, I'm not going to try to stereotype that person, but I think your average moviegoer is going to say, boy, that was terrible. I think even your Christian movie lover, your average Christian movie lover who just loves good movies, and they don't only go see Christian movies, but they just love great movies, they're going to look at this, they're going to say, they're going to feel embarrassed, they're going to feel ashamed, they're going to have something they care about so deeply associated with this. Man, when I was talking to my wife about this, I was just like, why did they have to tease us by getting these well-known names and faces involved in this movie and have them, you know, have these careers that make us hope that they could be bringing enough to this movie to raise up the overall caliber of the film? Why couldn't they just cast the usual, you know, no-name church volunteers so that we would know, okay, this movie is strictly for Christians who only watch Christian movies. The rest of us should steer clear because it's going to suck. But instead, they somehow, I have no idea how, got this small, less than a handful of really solid actors with, you know, great solid careers up to this point in Hollywood, gave me reason to hope. Oh, man, what a shame. So I want to talk a little bit about why I think Christian movies suck. And this is speculation on my part. It's based on just some impressions that I have of my life and talking to Christians in the past and my exposure to just kind of Christian culture, growing up in that culture myself as a Christian. I think one of the main reasons that Christian movies suck is because we don't have good teaching from the pulpit. And let me explain that. If we had better teaching from the pulpit, if in general, instead of being it being the exception, if in general we had teaching from the pulpit that was saying, hey, let's discern the difference between good and bad. Let's not just say, oh, that looks like it might be bad, so let's just throw it all out. And I'm talking about entertainment. I'm talking about how the church in the last, you know, at least 20 years that I've noticed, you know, as I've been alive, has largely, it's getting a little bit better, but has largely said, ooh, entertainment is bad. The church seems to kind of recoil from entertainment, especially the more weird and creative and interesting it might be. It's like, ooh, I don't know, that makes me uncomfortable. It's probably bad, you know? And even if we don't say those things, you know, out loud or like really definitively, and some people do, but many don't, there's still just kind of a feeling and an atmosphere that says, oh, you know, rated R movies, shouldn't see those, you know, if there's cursing or whatever, that's bad, we shouldn't see that movie, or if there's this and this in the music, then we shouldn't listen to it or whatever, you know, if there's this and than this in video games, then, you know, then we shouldn't do it. And don't get me wrong, there is content that, you know, that we do need to avoid, that can be harmful to us, that can harm our thinking and, you know, our priorities in life. You know, yes, absolutely. But what we tend to do is just say, well, no, just have this gut reaction of throwing, as I say, the baby out with the bathwater. You know, oh, man, that baby. Save the baby. Save the baby. We've got to save the baby. Oh, my gosh. Because when we don't save that baby, then we have this generation of Christians who value Scripture, maybe not as much as they should, because if they did, they'd maybe be discerning a little bit better and not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But we have this this generation of Christians that at least, you know, in some ways would certainly say that they value Scripture. But because they haven't been encouraged to be involved in art, be involved in creating art, be involved in experiencing art and thinking about art and, you know, pursuing art in their careers, you know, because we have a generation of Christians that have not been encouraged in that way, then what we end up with is a much smaller group of Christians who know anything about filmmaking to choose from when movies like this get made. And movies like this are only going to be made, I think, by people who are believers. Because even though it wasn't like really super strong, there was no like gospel presentation in this movie, it's still strongly enough focused on specifically Jesus, specifically Christianity, that I think like mainstream Hollywood is not going to make this kind of movie. I would find that very hard to believe if, say, the director of this movie was not a believer. So that's what we got to do. That's what we got to do. We got to demand that our teachers, our preachers, if they're like recoiling and saying, oh, don't go to the theater is the place of the devil, or don't do this or don't do that, you know, just these broad statements about entertainment types that we should not be partaking in, I think we got to sit down and have a talk with them. Don't yell and scream and freak out, because that's not going to get us anywhere. But we've got to, even just with the people that aren't in the pulpit, but we've got to just talk to other Christians and say, oh, really? You think that, you know, we shouldn't see that movie, like a movie like Noah or like Exodus, Gods and Kings, which is coming out this Christmas? I think Noah and Gods and Kings are likely going to be more conducive to getting to people to talk about and explore biblical ideas than this movie will, because those movies are at least well-made movies. And so people might see them, and at least we can talk about how they differ potentially from the biblical account. But people will see the movie, they'll be interested in it, they'll be interested in talking about it. The only people that are going to want to talk about this movie in a positive way and consider the themes that it's presenting are Christians, okay? And I think even that's going to be a select group of Christians. I think a lot of Christians, and certainly non-Christians, are going to say, yep, Christian movies still suck, moving on, and this movie is not going to spark any worthwhile conversation. So, man, it's such a disappointment. It could have been so much more. In summary, if I were talking to myself to whether or not to recommend this movie, I would say, Peter, freaking run. Run as far as you can, and hope at the same time that enough Christians go see this movie that a second one gets made. Maybe they could release this one on Blu-ray with the option to turn off the score. That would bump it up. That would make it not offensively bad. That would make it meh. which would be fine. I'll take over offensively bad, which I found this movie to be. Despite some really good moments from that core cast, they just couldn't rescue it. They couldn't bring it up. Man, I feel bad for them. But anyway, you know, hope that maybe this one will make enough money, kind of like God's Not Dead somehow made a ton of money, you know, and maybe they'll make a second one, but they'll learn from their mistakes and they'll say, okay, let's release a director's cut that cuts the score out of the first one. Try to get that into people's brains as like the real start of this series, the real representation of the start of this series, and then get a whole new writing team, a whole new director, just change up the entire production staff and maybe get the people involved. And who knows, maybe they were, for all I know. But, you know, the people involved that make, like, Facing the Giants and Courageous and Fireproof and stuff like that, my wife was making the observation that I would agree with, even though I've only seen one of those movies all the way through. The rest I've just seen kind of clips and stuff. But her impression, and I would agree, of those movies is that the acting isn't that great. But the filmmaking is pretty good. It's pretty solid. It's just the performances, you know, are kind of lacking. So I would say, yeah, get your big names and then get that production team. You get that combo together and maybe we can move forward the reputation of Christian, quote unquote, films in Hollywood. Till then, good luck, guys, if you decide to see this one. It's rated PG-13 for some thematic elements, violence slash peril, and brief drug content. I wish that some rough language would have been included in that, just on a personal level. They did stray from the source material a bit in terms of the story structure. They didn't do anything with Nikolai Carpathia or anything like that in this story. And I think it was fine for them to stray from the source material, but I wish one way they would have done that is by making people a little bit more realistic. And if you hang out with a bunch of people that are just real people, you know, you're going to hear at least some mild swearing every now and then. You're going to hear some rough language now and then. And what you had in this movie was like some rough people who were using some suspiciously clean expressions that just did not seem to fit the personality they were trying to go for. Weird, weird. Anyway, I gave it a quality score of 5.5 out of 10. It's a failure. It could have been lower than that. That 0.5 or maybe a whole point there I would give for what that core group of actors brings to it, but it's just not near enough to save this thing. Oh, so sad, so sad. Cut out the score, and that would bring it up maybe a point and a half to like a 7, maybe, or 6.5 at least. And a relevant score of 5.5 out of 10. You know, the themes are there. They're certainly noticeable, but I don't think they're going to stimulate any worthwhile thought about those themes or any worthwhile conversation about those themes because this movie is offensively bad. Anyway. There you go. Those are my thoughts on Left Behind, starring Nicolas Cage. I want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network. They're doing good stuff, like the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. Really, guys, check these out. For more info about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com. Captain Franson to Corporal McMinnery.
Sir, my name is... Okay, go ahead.
Hey, nobody up here right now. I'm looking at my console here. It looks like everybody's kind of clustering around the escape vessels. Could you round them all back up and get them back to their posts?
Yes, sir. I'll get right on that. Just stay there no matter what happens, and I will get back to you in at least...
20 seconds to auto-destruct.
40 seconds or so. Hello, and welcome back again to Trek Talk. Where there is no escape. We've discussed the series as a whole, but today I thought we would discuss what, in my opinion, is the best episode of Star Trek. Different people will have different tastes, obviously, but for me, this is the cream of the crop, the top of it all. And believe it or not, if you've been listening to my other Trek talks up until now, it's not a Deep Space Nine episode. It's a The Next Generation episode from Season 3. This is Star Trek The Next Generation, The Defector. The episode opens with Data on the holodeck acting out a scene from Henry V. Specifically, Act 4, Scene 1, if you want to get nerdy about it.
If you want to.
The theme of this scene, if you listen to the conversation, is all about how what a soldier does is disconnected from what his orders are. That the moral burden of a war falls on the commanders, not on the soldiers acting on the commander's behalf.
King is not bound to answer the particular endings of his soldiers, the father of his son, nor the master of his servant.
What's more, Data is playing Henry V, a king who disguises himself as a lowly soldier. Why would he do that?
Listen to what Shakespeare is telling you about the man, Data. A king who had true feeling for his soldiers would wish to share their fears with them on the eve of battle.
This will have a thematic recurrence later in the episode. Picard is called to the bridge to deal with the fact that there's a Romulan ship emerging from the neutral zone. Now, if you don't know what the neutral zone is, there's the Romulan Empire and the Federation, and there's a space called the neutral zone that their treaties have established between the two. Neither side is allowed to go into the neutral zone, so therefore neither one will interact with each other because there's a buffer between them. However, these Romulans are violating that, one Romulan ship chasing another. The small ship that's being chased asks for sanctuary with Picard, and Picard grants it. The Romulans, however, don't even argue or anything, they just go back to their own space. Curious. It turns out the defector is a lowly logistics clerk.
I must see your captain immediately.
We'll get you to sick bay after that.
This cannot wait! I have information vital to your survival.
He warns Picard that there's a massive Romulan fleet massing at one planet in the neutral zone and preparing for a massive incursion to start a war. But by secretly basing themselves in the neutral zone beforehand, they'll have a major advantage from the very beginning of the war, all the way through it. In other words, the Federation would likely lose this war, and it would certainly be more costly than even a standard war would have been, which the Federation would still try to avoid. However, every time they try to get any solid information out of this man, he refuses to give them anything, only telling them they have to go into the neutral zone and check for themselves. Well, unlike the first couple seasons of The Next Generation, Riker and Picard and the others aren't stupid, and they recognize this could easily be a trap. Trick the Enterprise into crossing into their space, and then they can claim that they're just defending themselves, that their war is justified, and they can get a lot more allies and help that way. Not to mention looking better in history.
That would not be an atypical Romulan ploy.
So that's the burden on Picard, is trying to decide whether this is a trap to try to lure them into making a first attack, or a legitimate chance to stop a war before it begins by catching them red-handed in their preemptive attack and sending them back to their space. No deaths, no war.
It's always a game of chess with them, isn't it?
But again, every time Picard tries to get something more specific, the clerk won't give him anything. He destroys his own ship once he gets on board the Enterprise, so the Enterprise engineers can't dissect the Romulan ship and figure out that technology. It should also be noted that during this time, Picard is having Worf speak to the Klingons. But then it's right back to our defector, again, not giving them any real information, just telling them, go into the neutral zone, find out for yourselves.
We're not going anywhere until we get to the truth.
I don't know, they might be able to hide a base from our probe. Its capabilities are limited.
We're at a stalemate. Picard's not willing to take the risk either way. To make matters worse, he gets this pre-recorded message from Earth.
There is no doubt in my mind that this will eventually fall on your shoulders, Jean-Luc.
The clerk, alone, ends up bonding with Data, as Data often bonded with the guest stars on Star Trek. And Data is able to use the holodeck to recreate a bit of Romulus for him. But seeing this piece of his home that he'll never get to see again because of what he's done reminds him that...
I have sacrificed everything. It must not be in vain.
And so he tells Picard...
Admiral Xerok wants to see him.
And there's a theme we had from earlier, a military leader disguising himself as a lowly soldier. Not to get the mood of his men, but to find a place among his enemies.
If I had irrefutable evidence... But you did not bring irrefutable evidence. You brought no evidence at all. And now I hear you are not the man you claim to be. Admiral, your credibility is stretched beyond belief.
However, Xerok is not just a Romulan admiral, but he's a notorious Romulan admiral.
One world's butcher is another world's hero.
Xerok finally reveals the reason that he did this in the first place. It was not only to protect his world from an unnecessary and costly war, but specifically to protect his newborn daughter.
She will grow up believing that her father is a traitor. But she will grow up.
I can't add anything to that. And when Xerok finally agrees to give some solid info, finally crossing the line into full-on traitor, willing to cause the deaths of other Romulans with some actual data that the Enterprise can use to take out the Romulan starships, Picard finally agrees to go to the neutral zone, take the risk, and brave it all to either stop a war...
or perhaps to start one.
They reach the planet, and they find no Romulans at all. No base, no ships, only a cloaked satellite that was giving off the signals that was part of their evidence earlier. Picard calls Xerok to the bridge, and he seems sincerely shocked that there's nothing here. And Picard suggests...
Is it possible they could have been feeding you disinformation? Could all this have been to test your loyalty?
And just as they realize what's really been happening, that this was a trap, but not really for them, but for Xerok himself, the Romulans appear. Yes, it was for Xerok, but they're willing to take the Enterprise as a trophy as well. And that's literally what they want to do with it.
After we dissect your Enterprise for every precious bit of information, I intend to display its broken hull in the center of the Romulan capital as a symbol of our victory. It will inspire our armies for generations to come, and serve as a warning to any other traitor who would create ripples of disloyalty.
But Picard is no slouch when it comes to military leadership himself, and he has a surprise in store. Those Klingons he was talking to earlier? They were always there.
Will still not survive our assault.
You will not survive ours. Shall we die together?
So now, instead of an easy victory, Tomalak, the Romulan leader, is now facing a Pyrrhic victory. Either they all go home, or they all die there. And Tomalak wisely chooses to go home instead. However, this was not the victory for everyone. As Xerok himself says,
I did it for nothing.
And facing the home he can never return to, the daughter he'll never know, Xerok takes the suicide pill he had brought with him from the very beginning, always planning to use, and performs the same final duty as the very first Romulan commander that we ever saw in Star Trek. However, what could be a bleak ending ends on at least a bittersweet and mildly hopeful note when Picard says,
"But if there are others with the courage of Admiral Jarok, we may hope to see a day of peace when we can take his letter home."
And the episode ends with that. If you haven't seen this episode, or even if you have for that matter, I recommend you watch it. I haven't done this episode justice because I had to give a quick summary. The episode plays out with perfect pacing. We spend just enough time in each scene to really get into it. We have character moments with Geordi and Data, Riker, Troy, Picard. Just about every character gets some significant moments. We allude to a previous episode, The Enemy, also a very good episode. Both the guest stars are stellar character actors of science fiction. If you're a fan of Babylon 5, you'd probably recognize Admiral Tomalak as the leader of the Narn. Jarok is played by my personal favorite Star Trek guest star, James Sloyan. He even elevates bad episodes he's in. And there you have it, my favorite Star Trek episode. It's not particularly fun, but it's a good episode. And again, if you haven't seen it or if you have, I recommend you check it out yourself somehow.
Guys, there's a world of geekiness out there I'd love to feature more of on the show. So if you'd like to contribute a review, news, or other geekery of any kind, go to spiritblade.net/submissions or just shoot me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. You don't have to be part of a special club. You look at a guy like Matt who's been delivering great content for the show. He didn't bribe me or anything, you know, so it's not hard at all. I would love to have you involved in creating what this show is. Again, paeter@spiritblade.net anytime.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. And lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
In this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the, what I call the churchy language, I guess, that we take for granted, using a little cultural history and linguistics now and then to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply some of what God has for us in these words today. This time, I'm just kind of doing a recap, I guess, of the book of Hebrews so far as we've looked at it. We've looked at chapters 1 through 6 and then the first 3 verses of 7. Then we took a few weeks off to look at the issue of emulation and abandonware. And so I thought it would be good after almost a month off to just kind of get a recap of Hebrews so we could kind of get back into some momentum for this and then jump back into the continuing verses of chapter 7 next time. So looking back, I think that a significant theme of Hebrews so far has been holding on to hope and confidence in Yahweh. That's God's personal name, Yahweh. Holding on to hope and confidence in Yahweh so that we can be engaged in his plans and experience his blessing and rest. In chapter 1, the author of Hebrews shows us that Jesus is superior to all messengers of God that came before him and is also the inheritor of all things in creation. So this, the author is saying, this is a person that we do not want to neglect listening to. In chapter 2, we're told that Jesus is the source of our rescue from the power and the penalty of sin. And we're also warned not to neglect the ongoing rescue that Jesus offers us. In chapters 3 through 5, we're told that there is a rest for God's people that the Israelites neglected, but that is still available to us today. A rest that is found in the midst of our intentional pursuit of God and participation in his plans. This rest is found by fully relying on Jesus to be our great high priest, trusting him, not our own efforts, to secure and maintain our good standing with God. The author explains in chapter 6 that believers who fail to increasingly pursue and place their trust in Jesus burn out or drift from faith as a result, and may even reject Jesus in contempt. Those who go down this road don't lose the gift of eternal life, and I think that's supported by John chapter 5, verse 24, Romans chapter 6, verse 23, Romans chapter 11, verse 29, and 2 Timothy 2:13. I did take some time to kind of go over that because I think that's a common misunderstanding of that section. But so anyway, those who go down this road don't lose that gift of eternal life. It's a free gift that's not taken away or refunded or whatever. But they do miss out on rest and reward. Believers do miss out on rest and reward as they drift away from Jesus, drift away from truth. The author doesn't want his readers to end up in that situation, and so he continues to build the case for trusting in Jesus to bring us and keep us in right relationship to God. Now, this goal of go-between that Jesus performs is the classic job description for a priest. But, you know, can any priest, including Jesus, really pull this off, really pull off that role of a go-between, a relational go-between between us and God? I don't know about you, but it's really hard for me to remember and really, really, truly, not just in theory and some lofty, nice idea type thinking, but really rely on the fact that Jesus and not my efforts is the reason for my relationship with God. You know, it's not that I fall into thinking that my efforts somehow earn or contribute to earning eternal life for myself. And that idea isn't even on the table for me. But on a more subtle level, I can easily fall into feeling like my significance and my usefulness to God and to the world is based on my capabilities and the results of my efforts. In truth, Jesus' ultimate incomprehensible act of love for me is what gives me value and significance, not my degree of talent, intelligence, creativity, or accomplishments. I don't even think it's my particular involvement in God's plans that gives my life significance. I used to think that, but I don't even think that it's my particular involvement in God's plans that gives my life significance. The fact that God wants me involved in his plans makes me significant all on its own. When I rely on myself for significance, I'm easily discouraged by repeated failure and shortcoming in my efforts. Maybe like me, you have some dreams or goals that you know aren't even close to being realized, and that keeps you discouraged or feeling just burned out and ready to just screw it and give up, you know? This kind of self-reliance, that whole mentality, I think seems to be humanity's natural tendency. It's why nearly every religion, including America's elusively vague spirituality, is based on sort of earning a higher state of existence or status through sincerity, we might say, or self-effort of some kind. It's the same mentality that was typically present in the Jewish culture around the time that the book of Hebrews was written. And so the author of Hebrews is calling his readers to set aside that old mentality of self-reliance that just seems to be burned into us by default, and to instead rely on Jesus, who provides significance, value, and rest from the burnout of a works-based mentality. But as I said, giving up that desire to create my own significance is hard in the day-to-day grind. It's one thing to acknowledge it intellectually and in theory and just kind of say, yes, I affirm that this is true, you know, when we're sitting back and being kind of these armchair philosophers and theologians, you know, and just kind of pleased with ourselves for how smart we are, you know. But it's another thing to give up that desire to create my own significance in like the gritty day-to-day moments of life. And I think that's hard for all of us, just like it was hard for the original readers of the book of Hebrews, which is why the author spends a large amount of time building the case for Jesus as the one who really can deliver on the promise of rest from self-reliance and also provide the significance that we're just aching for. And this brings us to chapter 7, where the case of Jesus is developed by comparing him to the king priest of the Old Testament, this Melchizedek guy. In verses 1 through 3, this comparison indicates that Jesus is our king, first of all, and that he should rule over all the details of our lives. Jesus is also the go-between for us in our relationship with our Creator, the greatest and highest being in existence. Jesus is the go-between for a relationship with that being. Jesus is able to teach us perfectly how to approach life and how to relate to God, because he himself is perfectly in line with God's perfect standards. Jesus is the source of peace for us in ways that are not detailed here in Hebrews chapter 7, but that are wide-ranging. And he's also in a category of quote-unquote priest that is all his own. I mean, unlike any priest before him, without beginning or end. You and I can continue to try and carve out and leave our mark on the world, impressing others with how interesting and quirky and unusual or how gifted we are, you know. We can try to find our significance that way, or we can renew on a day-by-day basis because, you know, we're just going to have to do it daily. We can renew on a day-by-day basis our trust in Jesus to provide rest from that futile, fruitless effort, giving us significance that doesn't depend on our reputation or accomplishments. And we're going to see more reasons that we can trust Jesus to do that for us as we continue in the book of Hebrews next time. Feedback, input, I want to hear from you guys. Request a review, give me your thoughts, questions, really whatever. It all helps me make this show better. Go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer, or just send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. Well, as a reminder, I want to greatly expand the number of Christian geek voices being represented at CGC. It's not Peter Franson Central, it's Christian Geek Central. That's the vision I have for it, is for a multitude of Christian geek voices being represented there. If you'd be interested in helping to provide content for the Christian Geek Central website or for the YouTube channel, and you know, promoting your own site or channel at the same time, because that's really the vision for Christian Geek Central, is yes, to provide unique content, you know, in and of itself, that's great and that's of wonderful value in equipping, encouraging, and inspiring Christian geeks. But I want to highlight geeks that are doing that kind of thing, or at least in doing one of those three things well elsewhere on the net. You know, I want to be a spotlight on what's going on in the geek sector of Christ's kingdom. And so I'd love for you to help me do that. Yeah, I'd love for you to promote your own site or channel at the same time that you're, you know, bringing content to Christian Geek Central. So please email me for more information at paeter@spiritblade.net. I want to remind you guys again about the Extra Life charity event that Christian Geek Central is involved in this month now. We are now in October, and the main default event is October 25th. By default, it's a big gaming marathon that geeks go and ask for donations to support them in, and then do this 24-hour marathon. I want to thank, by the way, those of you who came to the video game stream that I did this last Monday. It was my second stream working out technical issues, and there were certainly still some technical issues this time around, especially with the video. It's just kind of like, didn't work out at all. But I want to let you guys know, if you didn't see my update after that stream, that I spent Tuesday, really all of Tuesday, just hammering out technical glitches and troubleshooting and stuff like that. I am so excited. I didn't think this was going to be possible, but I found a solution, and I did some long-term tests on it, because, you know, sometimes things can work for 5 minutes but then get buggy after 30 minutes or an hour or something like that. And I did some long-term tests that indicate to me that I'm going to be able to have really very nice quality picture. I don't think I'm going to be able to get it up to like a perfect 1-to-1 1080p, but like 720. I'm pretty confident about. I mean, there's always that little bit of a downgrade when you're streaming or when it gets put up on YouTube. It gets a little bit blurry, you know, even though my software, you know, that I'm using and my hardware is able to capture, you know, at 720 and 1080. There's something that weird that happens when it goes from my PC to the internet. So I haven't figured that out yet. But it's still, all things considered, very clear, certainly comparable to a lot of, you know, what you see in video game streaming and video game stuff on YouTube. So I'm very happy with how the video game, the main footage that fills the screen is going to be looking. I also figured out a way. I can't believe this. I'm so excited because I'm so technically inept. But I figured out a way to get picture-in-picture video of me, like in the bottom right corner, and audio of me that is perfectly synced up with the game itself and that is has a great frame rate, isn't choppy and stuff like that. It just looks really nice. I'm so excited about that. I had to kind of think outside the box, and I'm having to buy a couple of cables to, you know, as a workaround solution. But anyway, I'm just very excited for the solution that I found there. So things are looking really good for a good quality 24-hour live stream for me as I play video games for 24 hours, October 25th, 7 a.m. through October 26th, 7 a.m. So I'm very excited about that. But you know what? I still need your help. So far, it's just me and two other team members that have officially signed up for the Christian Geek Central team for the Extra Life charity event, which makes that $1,000 goal, a fundraising goal that I've set for the team, a three-way split of $333. And, you know, that's just way too intimidating, I think, for all of us. So I'm pleading for five more people to sign up to join the Christian Geek Central team, and I'm asking you to be one of those people. We need your help if we're going to hit that $1,000 fundraising goal. And especially, so do these kids need your help who can't afford some critical and much needed medical care. You know, sometimes there can be a little bit of a hesitancy. I don't know, maybe this doesn't describe you at all, but for me, I used to feel like, like charities and fundraising, stuff like that, that weren't specifically identified with, you know, the gospel or the Christian message, you know, that should be somehow a lesser priority. And, you know, maybe there's some truth to that. Obviously, when we're thinking about on an eternal level, we do want to really make the gospel a priority as we are caring for people's practical needs, you know. But I think there was quite a while where I would just kind of downplay, you know, charity and in my involvement in charity work that didn't have the gospel explicitly attached to it. But as I have reflected more and more on the sovereignty of God, and how God can use anything to draw attention to himself, more and more I'm saying, you know, why in the world are we not more involved as believers in charities that aren't necessarily explicitly associated with the gospel, but that are still tangibly blessing and caring for people and being compassionate in a way that reflects the love of Jesus, you know? So I absolutely believe in the sovereignty of God, that even though, you know, the Children's Miracle Network, which Extra Life, this charity organization, funds their money to, even though, you know, these kids that are getting this free medical care are not going to be, you know, given the gospel presentation or something like that along with it, that God is sovereign and he can absolutely reveal himself through blessing people in these tangible ways, in ways that we just don't participate in. And so if you've been at all hesitant about getting involved with this because it's not explicitly like a Christian organization or something like that, I want to suggest that you also kind of consider the sovereignty of God and consider just trusting him to be sovereign and trust the promise of Romans 8:28, that all things work together for the good of those who love God and that are called according to his purpose, that he can orchestrate all these things to create this beautiful picture, and this can certainly be one of those things. So, and also, you know, if you're intimidated by, like, the idea of, like, crap, Peter, I'd love to help you. I cannot do a 24-hour marathon. That's just ridiculous for me to even think about that. Well, there are all kinds of ways to participate as a Christian Geek Central Extra Life team member. So if the idea of that 24-hour marathon is imposing or just plain unrealistic for you given your schedule, you don't even need to pick up a controller or roll any dice to join the CGC team. Of course, I think that's kind of missing the fun part, but it's still not vital. If you want to do something and kind of want to brainstorm alternatives to the marathon, get in touch with me, let me know, and there are absolutely alternatives that take a lot less time. Or if you're just like, Peter, I don't have time to add anything to my schedule, that's okay too. The most important thing for CGC team members is their willingness to invite others to participate in tangibly blessing children who need medical care that they can't afford. And as a reminder, Extra Life has a really nice form email you can use if you feel uncomfortable writing or talking to others. Or if you don't like their form email when you look into it, I wrote a modified version that I think feels just a little bit more, has a little bit more of a personal touch to it. So you can copy and paste mine if you want. Anyway, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask me. You can also find more info, donate, or sign up for the CGC Extra Life team on the CGC Extra Life page. Just go to ChristianGeekCentral.com and click on CGC Extra Life in that main navigation. And I do want to thank you guys for your consideration in that. I also want to thank Matt McKinney for his Trek Talk segment this week. Thank you very much, Matt. Guys, stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 to start from the beginning. Next week, I am going to be out of town. Actually, by the time this goes up, I'll either be on a plane or landing in Pennsylvania to visit with my wife's family and my, my in-law family, I guess. I mean, it's all family, whatever, in Pennsylvania. So I will be gone next week, but the show will not be. The show will still be here next week. If God wants it to happen, we'll have some commentary and some thoughts on Doctor Who Season 1, and then also a review of the book A Time to Die. And that review will be brought to us by John Wilkerson. Plus, keep an eye on the Christian Geek Central YouTube channel this coming week. I'm going to try and post my reactions to the Flash TV series pilot, which is going to be airing this coming week. I'm very excited about it. So if I'm able, I'm going to pull out my iPhone and record my thoughts on that. Probably in like my in-law's guest bedroom, and put those up on the website so you guys can see that. And then I'll bring those thoughts to this podcast the week after next. Till then, guys, thanks so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast as seek the truth.
Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Peter Frentzen with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.net. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
All right, just finished up episode 203 of Farscape Season 2, Taking the Stone. My notes on this one will be pretty short. It's not a super memorable episode for me, but neither is it what I would call a bad or unenjoyable episode. This is kind of like a meat and potatoes, I guess, episode of Farscape, that kind of like, this is in some ways the default feel, or one of the default choices they can have for the feel of an episode. You know, it's got some weirdness to it. It's not a wacky episode. They've got some of those, but it's not one of those. It's just got some darkness, some weight to it, some drama to it, just kind of some weird visual concepts and presentational things. You know, they got the usual kind of body horror type stuff that crops up now and then on Farscape when Chiana cuts the disc out of herself at the beginning, you know. And yet we've also got alongside that this kind of weighty emotional stuff that she's dealing with the discovery that her brother died. And so with this episode, I feel like we are given a reason, maybe the most substantial reason so far, to have compassion for Chiana, to care about Chiana. And so this, in that way, this is somewhat of a pivotal episode. It's not really continuity driven. You can skip this one and you'll be fine, but I feel like it does, if not develop Chiana as a character, I do think it develops Chiana as a character. It gives her substance because it tells us that she does care about somebody other than herself. She cares about her brother. So there is more to her. So definitely, you know, it adds something to who Chiana is.
I like Zan's Egyptian-inspired kind of clothes. She's got that kind of large brass-looking collar or breastplate, I'm not sure. But some of her costumes, you know, I don't like the fuzzy, hairy, gray one that she wears every now and then. This one is possibly one of my favorites. I just think it's a classy look. It just kind of evokes that ancient Egypt, you know, mythology kind of feel. I just like the way she looked in this one. We don't see her much, but I liked it. So we got these weird youths down on the planet with weird eyes and hand movements and weird speech and stuff. And that's just kind of an example of the strangeness sometimes that you can experience on Farscape. And that is probably the result of filming in Australia and being produced and thought up by many Australians. There's probably some Aboriginal influence in some of the movements that the characters do with their hands. That lead in particular, you know, of the kids down on the planet, kids. I mean, you know, I'm not sure what to call them. Young adults or whatever, because they're all, you know, in their late teens, or the actors are probably all in their very early 20s. But anyway, the youths, whatever you want to call them, the jumpers, we'll call them the jumpers. But kind of the chief one among them. I like that choice. I like that actor. I liked his performance. It was kind of weird and always kind of like high or something, but there was just kind of like a quiet madness behind his eyes, behind that vacant smile that he, you know, almost always maintained. There was this kind of madness, and I thought there was just kind of like there was just some nice subtlety to his character, you know, how he was able to put on this guise of always being excited and happy and, you know, behind the life that they've chosen, yet you can sense his uncertainty at the same time, buried way back in there somewhere, you know, behind his eyes. So I thought that was really good casting, even though, like, as a character, I'm like, I don't like this guy. He makes me feel weird and icky, and I'm, you know, so definitely, you know, not one of my favorite episodes, but not what I would call a bad episode. Unless you hate Chiana, then I don't know that this episode is going to redeem her for you, but hopefully it will make her a little less hate-worthy. Yeah, so that's it. That's really all I have for this episode. Now we're going to start a series of great episodes in season two. And more these episodes become what I would call great episodes, or memorable episodes, or that episode where, oh, you know, where something changed forever, or, you know, in terms of the status quo, or just things that were memorable. And next episode, Crackers Don't Matter, kind of gives you a hint at kind of how wacky the show can get. It's not the wackiest episode, certainly, in the series, but it's a bit off the wall and just does some really fun things with the show, but at the same time not forsaking, you know, the other things that are great about the show. But we'll talk more about that next time. And then after that, a really great heavy episode, The Way We Weren't. So we got a couple of really, really solid episodes coming up that I look forward to talking about starting next time.